want to talk about today is work that I've been doing with Dean Townsley, who is a graduate student here, is now a postdoc at Chicago, and with Heis Nellemans, who's now in Nijmegen. And part of this will actually be old context. I realized as I started to prepare this that it probably doesn't hurt to let you know that there's some things we've learned about classical novae that might be relevant to this crowd. And this long paragraph here is saying something quite simple, which is that if you want to find accreting binaries far away, the only way you'll see them is in, for example, their merger event, which Searle sort of talked about and which Ed will tell you. Type 1a supernovae, when they finally die. But they have, in between coming into contact and maybe a final event, many of these binaries have successive flashes of material that's been dumped onto their surfaces. And those flashes allow us to really measure these populations in distant galaxies. It's the only thing we really see. As Alan Shafter showed today, the classical novae events themselves are actually how we detect these systems at higher, larger distances. So let me first just set the stage for you and remind you a little bit about what happens if I dump hydrogen onto a white dwarf. So shown here are as a function of the mass of the white dwarf on the bottom and accretion rate, what are the outcomes? There's a very narrow range for stable hydrogen burning. By stable, in this case, it's I'm burning it at the rate I accrete it. There's a very narrow accretion rate regime for that. For any mass white dwarf, if you put matter on at an accretion rate less than that, it will undergo limit cycles of accumulating and flashing. And those flashes are what we observe as classical novae, and I'll summarize that in some detail today. And we have binaries that we think fall in these classes. So what are called super soft sources, which are roughly systems that are burning hydrogen stably and happen to have, from binary evolution, the ability to have a supply rate sitting in this factor of two gap, which typically requires thermal timescale mass transfer, those are what are called super soft sources, which are seen typically by ROSAT in our galaxy and in the Magellanic clouds. And those are a good system if you want to actually accrete up to high masses to get ignition of the core, because you're actually adding the material on and it's staying, at least the hydrogen staying. However, there's a large number of systems we see which with much lower accretion rates, cataclysmic variables, and these actually all undergo unstable hydrogen burning, leading to classical novae. And shown on here are the ignition masses. This is 10 to the minus 5 solar masses of material ignites, 10 to the minus 4 is this regime, and I'll summarize how we actually calculate these. So what are these cataclysmic variables? Well, they've sort of been summarized a little bit. Roughly speaking, what we know in our galaxy is about 1 in 100 white dwarfs end up this way. They're optically variable objects. And shown here is a sort of the party line as to what happens when a system comes into contact, in this case with the initial 0.8 solar mass main sequence star at a certain time, starts mass transfer. This is the accretion rate going from 10 to the minus 8 to 10 to the minus 9 as the orbital period shrinks from 8 hours down to about 2 hours. Then we have the period gap, the place where the star becomes fully convective, shrinks inside the Roche lobe, and you need to wait for gravitational waves to bring it back into contact, after which mass transfer is driven mostly just by gravitational wave losses, and the system again goes down to a period minimum of about 60 minutes, and after which you have a brown dwarf donor, and the system evolves actually out, and the accretion rate drops dramatically. So these are systems we know and love in our galaxy, and what I'm going to do for you today is summarize a little bit of the work we've been doing to understand how much mass you actually have to dump on the white dwarf as a function of this evolution to get the classical novae ignition, and then that will tell us how to translate the observed classical novae rate to how many underlying systems there must be. What you'd like to do is to be able to take the number of 30 or 50 or 100 per year seen in M31 and say, fine, if there's that many per year, it requires a million CVs or whatever. And I'll give you that normalization, which we can get by doing theory. So what's the challenge? Well, the challenge is to actually get rid of one free parameter. As was mentioned earlier, I have the mass of the white dwarf, I have the rate of accretion, and I have the core temperature. And obviously, the core temperature matters because the core and the matter I've put on are in thermal contact. I have a very hot core. It's much easier to ignite. Well, what was done now about 2 or 3 years ago by Dean Townsley and myself was to actually calculate the core temperature self-consistently and get rid of it as a free parameter. And that ends up allowing us to do quite a lot. So how do we do that? Well, this just shows schematically, but let me just say it in words. at any given moment, if I'm accreting at a certain rate and I have a mass, if I know the mass of the white dwarf, I can basically calculate at early times I have a thin envelope, in which case the white dwarf is cooling. At late times, near ignition, the envelope's very thick, and that thick thermal blanket means that the white dwarf actually gets heated. And so I just calculate what the temperature needs to be so that through the classical Novi cycle of accumulating fuel, I on average do not heat or cool the core. Okay? So I calculate a steady state temperature as a function of accretion rate. And that's just shown here. So as a function of a given accretion rate, let's say 10 to the minus 10 solar masses per year, at this temperature of 6 by 10 to the 6 Kelvin, the white dwarf is neither heated nor cooled. And then all you have to do is ask, can you actually reach this equilibrium? And the answer for most of these systems is there is time. There's some subtleties, and actually Townsley's working on that right now. But this lets us get rid of the core temperature as a free parameter. Okay, so that's no longer an issue. That allows us to calculate the ignition masses of the classical Novi. And so this is shown in this diagram. So this is the ignition mass, how much hydrogen, helium, sort of cosmic composition stuff I need to put on a white dwarf as a function of accretion rate for three different masses, 0.6, 1, and 1.2. And what you see is that at low accretion rates, the ignition masses are quite large. That's because the white dwarf is cold. And at high accretion rates, the white dwarf is much hotter, and the ignition mass is down by almost a factor of 10. Okay. Now, if you read textbooks, or even worse, papers, what you'll see everybody do is say that the pressure of ignition is a fixed number. And they pull a number out. Pressure is 10 to the 20. And of course, God's units, CGS. Okay. That would mean that the ignition mass would scale as r to the fourth over m. So shown on here is, if that scaling were true, how different the ignition masses would be going from a 1.2 to a 1 and a 1 to a 0.6. Okay. So what you see immediately is that what everybody's been assuming is nowhere near the truth. We see much less variation with mass than expected. And most of the variation of the ignition mass is actually with the accretion rate, not the mass of the white dwarf. Okay. Well, what's the sanity check? The first sanity check then is to say, wait a minute, if I'm seeing a classical Novi and I want to ask how much matter's been put on it, I better know the accretion rate, because if it's accreting slowly, it'll have much more material than if it's accreting rapidly. Well, the proxy for the accretion rate is the orbital period, because we think we know something about how the accretion rate scales at the orbital period. And so what's plotted here are the theoretical calculations we've done of the ignition mass as a function of orbital period. So these are these lines for 0.6 and 1. So remember, at high orbital periods, the m dot's high. At low orbital periods, the m dot's lower, and the ignition masses are higher. And then plotted up are the embarrassing situation that there's only five classical novae for which the observers had measured an ejected mass and an orbital period. There's of order 60 classical novae for which we have the orbital period. There's of order 60 classical novae for which we have the ejected mass. But the product of those two is five systems. Okay. So this is the first. So I have to be honest, when we plotted these five data points up and put our theorem, we were shocked that this is a log-log plot, at least this axis. It was reassuring that we weren't off the plot. But the main point I want to make here is that what you see is that the amount of mass ejected in classical Novi is of order that accreted. So you'll hear people say you eject 10 times what you accrete, or 5 times what you accrete. We don't see that from this, but this is something hopefully that will get only better with time. Okay. Now, because of this variety, if an observer goes out and measures the orbital period distribution of classical Novi, you need to have this input to do that inference. And so the next plot, I'll show what that looks like. So just look at the bottom plot. The histogram are the orbital periods of roughly 50 classical novae that Brian Warner accumulated, published about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago now. So again, these are systems which you go out long after the event, measure the orbital period, and you see that there's many fewer down here. Most of them are up here. Okay, well, you can immediately understand why that is. At long orbital periods, the accretion rate's high, and the accumulated mass is low. So it takes much less time to get the ignition. Okay? And so what we can do is take the ignition mass, as I showed you, and the basically the accretion rates from, in this case, sort of the ballpark for magnetic braking that everybody uses, and calculate what we would expect, and that's the solid line. Okay. So this worked better than we expected in the sense that we could actually basically take the ignition masses and CV evolution and calculate what the expected orbital period distribution would be, and it was close enough that we thought maybe we're onto something here. So the next exercise to do is then say, fine, if I understand the classical Novi recurrence rate as a function of orbital period, and an observer tells me how many classical Novi there are somewhere, I can actually calculate how many CVs I need. Okay. So, what did we do? So the conclusion of this work was we actually now have the classical Novi recurrence rate as a function of all orbital periods. And so we can just take the numbers, so I just took the numbers from Williams and Shafter of roughly 2 classical Novi per year and a 10 to the 10 L Sun galaxy, k, scale to K. How many cataclysmic variables do I have to be born per year to get that population? That's this number. Okay, so this is how many CVs per year you have to be making in this size of a galaxy to explain the observed classical Novi rate. Okay? So it's a normalization. You can take the normalized numbers and then just ask how many CVs would I need. Okay? And you can also check this roughly scales with the local density that you see in our galaxy if you just take the K-light density. Okay, so this is the birth rate of cataclysmic variables as inferred from the classical Novi rates. Well, there are many, though I'm not one of them, that talk about cataclysmic variables as type 1As. The reason we don't think that's possible is that everything we've done in many different contexts tells us that most of the white dwarfs are maybe one solar mass at the end, not anywhere near the Shannon-Sakhar mass. So we don't think there's reason to believe that this population leads to 1As. However, I can tell you that this is the 1A rate in an old population. Okay? So it's a measure of using the classical Novi to get a rate of the CVs born per year, and you can at least do a sanity check. If you wanted these to all become 1As, are there enough? And the answer is yes, but I don't actually think that's possible. Okay? All right. Well, what we're working on now is the notion that very late in the times of these systems, they actually have, as the white dwarf cools and you get to the last 6 gigayears of the life of these systems, the accumulated mass really grows to quite large values, order 10 to the minus 3 solar masses. And this had been mentioned actually by Eben and Tunikov as a potential way to explain this M31RV that actually Sri showed earlier today. It's not clear to me that's going to work, but I can at least give you some rates so we can at least carry this population forward and at least ask the question or answer the question as to what the rate of these events would be. So roughly there's sort of 20 flashes, the 20 last flashes, if you will, where the mass is some big number. That's out of about 6,000 classical Novi. Okay. So you're talking a rate that's maybe 1/1000th of the classical Novi rate, which is still 10 times the 1A rate. Just so you know, per K light, if you look at an old galaxy, the classical Novi rate is 10 to the 4 times the 1A rate. Okay? So that's so that if you just want to have a sense, per K light, you get for one type 1A supernova, you'll get 10 to the 4 classical Novi, which is why you should study classical Novi. Okay? Okay, so this is work in progress. I can't say yet what we think these will become, but it's definitely true that at late times you get some pretty big flashes. All right, so the last 5 minutes, what I want to talk about is more recent work we've been doing on AM-CAN-VAN binaries. These are the systems that Stroll mentioned, where you have a helium and a CO white dwarf that come in, reach contact, but in this case, they don't merge. The mass ratio is extreme enough that the helium white dwarf can back out over time and do mass transfer. And there's a large number of these systems now. These are the orbital periods in minutes. Here are the 2 that Stirl mentioned. But you see they go all the way down to about 65 minutes. So there's a large class of these systems. There's 4 more that Sloan has found for which they don't have orbital periods yet. And the defining properties are no hydrogen lines, helium and nitrogen. The nitrogen's there due to the CNO burning. And basically, the optical UV colors are just an accretion disk and a hot white dwarf. Okay, so these are interesting binaries. It's a CO white dwarf that is having helium dumped onto it. what do these systems look like as a function of orbital period? So they start at some very short orbital period, and then you just have gravitational wave emission driving the binary. So m dot is being set by j dot. As angular momentum is lost, the system is doing mass transfer, and the orbital period is increasing. And roughly in a Hubble time, you'll get out to around 60 or 70 minutes. Okay, so it starts off at a very short period. It's undergoing mass transfer. And what you see is that the mass transfer rate drops about 5 orders of magnitude. Okay. So the question that we've started to work on is, I'm dumping helium onto this carbon-oxygen white dwarf at rates that go by 5 orders of magnitude. Will that be interesting as a helium flash? Okay, so how does this work? So this is the same plot I've just shown on here, the systems that we know and love, not all of them. And this has been talked about a little bit in the literature, but I'll show you the sort of the current best understanding of it. At the very onset of accretion, the accretion rates are quite high. That means that the helium layer is quite hot, and it undergoes weak explosions, if you will, sort of helium novae. However, what we realized, and it's gotten us interested in the problem, is there comes an accretion rate, and I'll show you the plot in a moment. It depends on the mass ratio, but let's say 10 to the minus 7, where the amount of helium I have to put on the carbon-oxygen white dwarf exceeds the mass of the donor. Okay? So in the hydrogen case, because the hydrogen shell masses never get above 10 to the minus 3, my donor, which maybe gets down to 0.05 solar masses, sort of a very shaved off main sequence star, it always exceeds the mass of the shell. Okay? But in the helium, the opposite can occur. And it's just because the helium I need to put on a cold white dwarf is a much larger number because it's triple alpha ignition rather than PP. So that's shown here in some preliminary calculations that Heise has been working on. So the red line shows the ignition mass of helium as a function of accretion rate. That's the red line. And don't worry about the curvature of these for a moment. This just shows the accumulated mass growing up, having an explosion, coming back down, growing up, having an explosion. And you can see that at some point, in this case, this would be the last flash, which would have a mass that's that large. And then after that, the accumulated mass grows and grows and grows, but it doesn't ignite. It just misses this curve. Okay? Everybody see that? So you have maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, 10 flashes. Okay, now for this issue Stirl talked about the P dots, actually this is what Heise is actually working on. This might help with the P dots. Here's if you have a 1 solar mass white dwarf, the ignition masses are smaller because gravity's higher and you get more flashes. Okay. So how does this work? Well, this bottom plot is from an old work by Fujimoto and Sugimoto who talked about this problem. And basically, the simple point I want to make is that if you have a flash of a tenth of a solar mass of helium on a white dwarf, it will most likely detonate and make a tenth of a solar mass of material that goes to infinity that might just be a tenth of a solar mass of nickel, probably leaving behind the CO white dwarf, perfectly happy. It just experienced this event, but it doesn't matter. So what's the rate of these? So we don't know the numbers of these binaries. Stirl just hopefully made that clear to you. This was roughly if we take this number, which is actually almost what Stirl showed, what would be the helium novae rate in M31? Well, it would be about 1 in 300 classical novae would be one of these helium novae. So think Eddington limited, but no hydrogen. So you would not find them in your H-alpha survey. You would not find them in an H-alpha survey, right? And the nickel-rich events would be about 1/10 of the 1A rate. Okay, so if every one of these gave you 1 nickel, 10th of a solar mass ejection of pure nickel, that's about 1/10 of the type 1A rate. And so hopefully this is motivating you a little bit to see why I think there's still some phase space for more work. And I'm at 19:20. Perfect. Thank you.
Your predicted distribution of observed PBs as a function of period fit remarkably well.
Yep.
Using magnetic braking.
That's right.
Seems to be dodgy and suspicious.
Yep.
How well constrained do you think the magnetic braking actually is? Is it the truth? It must be the truth? Or is it not too sensitive to that?
There's a lot of reasons why we have to have a much higher m dot above the period gap than below. It's not just this. If you look at the effective temperature distributions of the white dwarfs, you need it. I'd say the only thing I could add is that if you look at the magnetic white dwarfs, and you look at their accretion rate distributions, they actually have a lot of evidence for a magnetic white dwarf seems to turn off magnetic braking in the donor. There's a lot of data that shows us that, and you'll also see it. I don't have a chance to talk about it here, but there's a lot of magnetic noving. And if you look at their orbital period distribution, it's noticeably different. And so it seems like there's some evidence that a magnetic white dwarf in the system, especially when it's locked, modifies dramatically the angular momentum loss from the binary.
The dwarf nova period distribution also indicates that you have to have much higher mass transfer rates above the gap. Because most dwarf novae are below the gap.
More that there's prescriptions in the magnetic rate. Wondering how well constrained the prescriptions were.
But
a step function across the
step
gap.
Step function and injection. You really need to have systems coming in being born at these different orbital periods. You can definitely rule out that they're all born at 8 or 9 hours and evolve through. Which again, that's not too surprising, given the mass ratios.
So, the idea that 2002 CX is a result of, one of your helium flashes. So I have two questions. One is, are you just conjecturing that it will burn all the way through nickel?
That depends.
Or you followed it up that shows it burns all the way to nickel.
So that depends on what the pressure in the shell is. So let me say physically first. So the maximum temperature of the burning is basically set by all of the nuclear energy release goes into the radiation pressure. So if I have a very thick shell on a massive white dwarf, the pressure is very high, and I can get to a maximum temperature high enough that I can go into NSC and get my nickel. And that's actually shown, that's this line. So I'd ideally like to have this, all these points be a little bit above this line. In which case, I probably very safely get nickel 56. As I go down into here, I don't probably get quite to NSC. So what we haven't done yet, is to do those calculations. But it depends completely on the thickness of the shell, because that sets the maximum temperature that the flash can get to.
Okay. So
I wouldn't by any means say I've shown it. Yeah.
Okay. So the question then is, okay, let's say nickel is made. But here, unlike the supernova problem, the delta, the mass of ejecta is very tightly constrained, as you can see from your y-axis.
Right.
Right? So the question I have for Weidong is, we are not talking of half a solar mass. We're really talking of, at the most,
let's say 0.1.
0.1 solar masses, right, of which some fraction will be nickel.
Yep.
I mean, this is one hell of a fast evolving supernova.
Yep.
The speed has to be extremely high.
Yep.
And unfortunately, the supernova itself is kind of fast, but not that fast.
Yeah.
This is still kind of more like a 180. It's not really out of the lead.
Well, 2002 CX, I mentioned both for two reasons. One is that I've read the paper now, I think, three times. But not realizing I'd read it. And every time I had the same idea, which is it's one of these. And you guys actually even mention it. So it is a funny event. It's an example of an odd supernovae that, of course, many people would like to reclassify. It doesn't fall in the Phillips relation. So people would like to,
Yes, but it is a 180.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Maybe I misunderstood some of your initial statement, but you say that the strength, the dragging parameter which determines the strength of another outburst is an m dot rather than the mass of the white dwarf?
Yes. We find more variation with accretion rate. Here's a simple plot to see. So here's a 0.6 versus a 1. The difference in ignition mass between the two masses and the difference in ignition mass of the orbital period, which is n dot. So, both variations matter, but the point is people have assumed that the strength in the variation with mass was just scaling as a constant pressure scaling, and that's definitely not true. So we do find dependence on mass. It's much weaker than previously assumed, and we find a lot of variety with accretion rate. And this is the only way you can understand the classical Novi orbital period distribution. Remember, 95% of CVs are below the period gap. So if you didn't do this, you'd have a big problem, because when you look at the classical novae, they don't have that orbital period distribution.
This point, I have a simple question, very short. how do you explain the fact that we observe a fast and bright nova not above 200 parsecs from the galactic plane, while the faintest low can be observed up to 1,000 parsecs, for example? The most straight interpretation is that massive white dwarfs are concentrated close to the galactic plane because they are cast from more massive congenitors, so they are more massive, and they are related to brighter and faster events.
So I think
it's difficult to me to state that M-block is a main parameter. I mean, you should make a comparison with those observations. At least you should try to explain this stratification.
Yeah, so let me just make it a little bit clearer. So I think the main punchline from what we've done is that the dependence on mass of the ignition mass on the mass of the white dwarf is much less extreme than assumed. That's clear from the calculations. The range of diversity we find in accretion rate is comparable to that from mass. Okay, that's sort of what this plot hopefully makes clear. 0.6 to 1 is the range we see in CVs. I mean, we don't see 1.3 solar mass white dwarfs in CVs.
One last question. I'm asking for a rule of thumb. If I look at the accumulated ejecta, the accumulated mass of all the ejecta over the lifetime of the system, in NOVA, how does that go as a
function? Well, I think the simplest hypothesis right now is all the mass put on in calculating variables comes back out.
On average.
That's the simplest hypothesis.
Or, I mean, as a sum.
So everything you put on leaves. And there's evidence in some cases, roughly sort of 1 in 10 classical nova, that you actually see carbon and oxygen enhancement in the abundance, which can maybe be 20% carbon and oxygen, maybe 30%. That's telling you that you are actually, in some cases, dredging up carbon and oxygen from the underlying white dwarf enough to you know, you have to be ejecting some of the white dwarf as well, some excavation. This is unfortunately the state of the art in asking, does the ejected masses exceed or not the accumulated mass? And you can see, and you can infer what you want from that. But.
Yeah, and then does the sum compare favorably or unfavorably with the ejecta from the ordinary, your favorite supernova, where you just have one enormous ejecta?
Sorry, so in this case, you start with a 0.5 solar mass main sequence star, and 5 giga-years, that 0.5 is now down to 0.08, and that 0.4 solar masses has gone to infinity.
Right.
And that's the, that's the answer.
You can get recurrence times of 20, 30 years without having very massive white dwarfs over a solar mass?
I didn't talk about recurrent nova here. So I can't answer that, but I can say that there's recent work by Ken Nemoto on looking at very close to the boundary of stability, instability, as well as Ken Shen, who's a graduate student here, who's been working on this as well. Ken somewhere, he was here earlier. To ask, can you get, what's the range of, if you see a recurrent nova of 20 years, and you, what's the mass the white dwarf must be? And the number, I mean, you can do it, but you have to be near Shannon Sakara. Right? But those M dots are high. Those M dots, you can't get from CV.
But if you have a continuum of recurrence times, then there should be a lot of sort of what we call classical.
Yeah. I don't think, we don't seem to have binaries. I mean, the binaries we see tend to be either here. Actually, this is pretty unusual, high M-dot, or mass transfer. I think there is a bit of a gap in M-dot. So these would be unstable, and they probably are flashing, but there seems to not be binaries that fill that M-dot space.
Yes, thank you. And the next